Father Thomas Keating, in addition to being one of the original peace counselors, members of the Peace Council, is a Trappist monk. He joined the Cistercian order in 1944, served as superior of the monastery in Snowmass for many years, and was abbot of the monastery in Spencer, Massachusetts, the Abbey in Spencer, Massachusetts, for many years. He is very well known as one of three visionaries behind the Centering Prayer Movement. It's a contemporary movement of contemplative prayer that grew out of St. Joseph's Abbey during his tenure there in 1975. He's also one of the founders of Contemplative Outreach, an international ecumenical spiritual network that teaches the practice of centering prayer. Contemplative Outreach provides a support system for those on the contemplative path through a wide variety of resources and workshops and retreats and so on. He's been part of the global interfaith movement, interreligious movement, for many years. He started the Snowmass Interreligious Conference in 1982, and I can tell you from experience that that's long before most groups were thinking at all about interreligious outreach. He served as past president of the Temple of Understanding, one of the most prominent of the American interreligious groups, and also is a co-founder of Monastic Interreligious Dialogue. I'll be asking him about that today and his experience there with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So welcome, Father, and if you'd lead us in a moment of centering, I think we'd all be very grateful.
Well, thank you, Jim, and so I invite you just to relax a bit where you're sitting or standing even, and let go for just this moment of everything that's on your mind, because deep within, as you know, is the divine ground, or the ground of being from which we emerge at every nanosecond of time, and which is always waiting for our attention. And while it fills us with all the energies we have, it's ready to give us much more in the way of energy and grace and empowerment if we listen. And so let's take just a minute or two, enter our own depths to the silence of the divine ground, to wait that presence. Let us now bring our silence to an end, but our capacity to listen, let us bring that renewed capacity to this discussion so that we might have a critical ear to both benefit and to improve on it. So, Jim, please take on from here.
Thanks, Father. Our topic for today, as you all know, is peace and the inner life. I just want to read you briefly from our background piece that's on the website. What is the alternative to a culture of violence that thrives in so many regions of the planet? Thomas Keating suggests one real possibility. Quote, as we confront the crisis of civilization, culminating in the specter of humanicide, is there an alternative to the present plunge of humanity toward the abyss of utmost violence? There is an alternative. It is the commitment to the practice of charity. In the Hebrew language, the term for charity is hesed, love that is boundless and everlasting. In Greek, agape, love that is totally selfless. In Latin, caritas, unconditional love. In English, charity or loving kindness, limitless compassion for suffering at every level of human experience. Thomas Keating, a Trappist monk, a teacher of contemplative centering prayer, has been a peace activist for most of his life. For him, however, the key to building peace in the world lies in cultivating peace in one's heart. The gradual enrichment of the inner life leads to a healing of the outer world. So thank you, and thank you, Father Thomas, for being here. Barbara?
Well, I think at this point, most of our folks are eager to jump right into your conversation with Father Keating. And I know that one of your favorite questions to begin, if you don't mind me asking it, is to ask Father Keating that we know you've been involved in the Peace Council since it began in 1995. So I wonder if you can recall an experience with that group that was particularly meaningful to you and share it with our listeners today.
Well, sure. There were any number of events that stand out in my mind, but I just think of one in a special way that took place in Belfast, Ireland. At that time, the controversy there was still in its bloody stage. And the Peace Council made a point of going to places that were racked by some degree of conflict. And so we all arrived there from all around the world and started the meeting. And we found out afterwards that on several occasions when we moved in public and people saw all the different religious garbs that we had, the Buddhist and the Jewish and the monk habit that I had on, plus any number of others, they were simply blown away. They had never seen all the religions of the world together in a peaceful, friendly attitude and saw that we were kind of having a good time with each other. So it was perhaps the most impressive statement we made to that group of people that religions can actually be one, and maybe their own religion could bury some of the hatchets of these centuries. In any case, not to prolong these examples, maybe that would do for your purposes, Barbara.
Yes, yeah, it's beautiful. I remember when we during the Parliament in Chicago in 1993, that was an experience that was mirrored there. That people were wearing the dress of their religious traditions in the hallways and in the elevators, and for most of the people who attended, and there were nearly 8,000 people there, it was their first experience with having a picture of that kind of harmony, that pretty much changed their picture forever of the fact that religions are often contentious or even at war with one another, and that wouldn't be what they would expect, and yet it was a very joyful experience. Jim, did you want to move on with the next question?
I just want to add to that, Father, the idea that these peace counselors throughout the history of the organization have really gotten to know each other. There are very close friendships that have blossomed. And I think that's something that people in the many places we visited have always noticed. I loved the way you said that these people seem to be having a pretty good time together. And that was always one of the ideas behind the organization. If we could bring people into a situation, leaders from various traditions, where they could get to know each other and like each other and understand each other better. And I recall a visit to Chiapas, and after a ceremony in the cathedral there in the Diocese of Chiapas, the bishop of that diocese, Samuel Ruiz Garcia, who passed away just last month, and Maha Gosananda, the late Supreme Patriarch of Cambodian Buddhism. These two really hit it off, Father, as you'll remember. And there's a wonderful photo of the two of them walking through the streets of Chiapas, each one with his arm around the other, and laughing uproariously. They became very fast friends, untroubled by the theological or Buddhological differences that might have separated them otherwise. Well, today we'd like to talk about the vital link between the inner life and peace work. And I recall, Father, a story about St. Teresa in the 16th century urging her young followers to combine contemplation with action, to deepen their inner lives as well as taking their compassionate service to the streets. But contemplation and action have often been at odds in the world's religions, the notion that you really need to choose one path or the other. But often it seems most powerful when they are combined. Can you reflect on that for a bit?
Well, certainly to separate them would be a serious mistake, because it's really very hard to have an integral action for the healing of the world and a deep contemplative life, which also is aimed at the healing of the world, but by separation from a lot of the world's distractions, silence, and a lot of meditation. So the main thing is that as these two aspects of our spiritual journey grow, we have to try out the contemplative life that is hopefully beginning to burgeon inside of us by allowing it to be struck or in conflict with the inevitable opposition or persecution sometimes that occurs when you bring a spiritual message onto the street. It's not always well received, and it should be presented with a good deal of prudence. So the balance between the two is perhaps best summed up this way. If you have all contemplation without adequate action for your talents, you may find yourself getting somewhat isolated or even alienated or a little bit on the narcissistic side and seeking solitude and peace and loneliness and an ideal hermitage for some subtle but hidden motives of ego. And the main thing to get rid of course, we all know, is ego. Where you do this is of secondary importance, but the ego has to be moderated very much. And so in an activity, the genuineness and the sincerity of our contemplation, our union with God, is tested and challenged and deepened and resisted even, so that our capacity to choose it and to deepen it and to try to bring its fruits into our activity becomes a continuous exchange. And so this takes some time. That's why there's a certain enormous advantage in having activity that brings us in contact with many different people and many different kinds of experiences, because God is present in all these things around us. And though we don't see it at first, through the opening of the inner eye of faith, of contemplation, one begins to perceive this mystery of the presence or the ever-present awareness or the ground of being in everything, or the house of God, if to use that terminology, in which everything that exists is within God, like in the womb of God, if you prefer an image that's living rather than a house. So to live both in the house and on the street, that is to say in the wear and tear of everyday life, this seems to be the best formula. If we do too much activity, we're liable to get exhausted or burnt out, as they say. If we don't do it, if we overemphasize being alone, we may get a little bit selfish in spite of our best intentions. But the two together, like two wings of a bird, will help to move things along, even to move them into the fastest arena that we know of, which is the air. Okay.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's wonderful.
And in that same spirit, the Peace Council has always tried to integrate shared spiritual practice into its gatherings. And I I recall particularly our visit to the Trappist Monastery in Gethsemane in Kentucky, where the late Father Thomas Merton had his hermitage. And there you led the group in a centering prayer workshop. And as I mentioned in the introduction, you're associated as one of the architects of centering prayer. Can you tell us a little bit more about this practice? You've worked so diligently to foster it around the world. And as part of that, can you address a question that comes up often? Is there something about the centering prayer approach or method that makes it particularly useful for Westerners?
Well, I'm inclined to think so, but I won't assert it as certain because we're still experimenting. It's been in existence since 75, but it gradually grew out of the monastery. We didn't have that intention when we first started. We thought, well, we'll just offer it to people who come on retreat in the guest house. But it soon became apparent that certainly not just Catholics and Protestants, but other people of other faiths were very interested in it. And so it happens to speak to a desperate need of our time, which you all know so well, which is the hunger for meaning or the loss of confidence in religious practice and in some degree in the fruits of the Enlightenment, since two world wars kind of knocked into a cocked hat the idea of continuous progress. It takes a little more than scientific research to complete the development of human beings, of course. So centering prayer is simply a little method of learning to be silent and to open ourselves to the silent dimension of human nature, which, at least in my view, somewhat based on experience, is innate in everybody. So you can count on it being there. And although some people are kind of buried under the debris of false self issues and over-identification with their group to the point of dishonesty and undue dependence on any group for satisfy our desperate need for security. So this is moderated when we come in contact with the deepest values of our being, which is silence. Silence is like God's first language, you might say. Or it's that out of which everything has come and probably will return. Therefore, perhaps the easiest and best, although has its difficulties, access to the silence of our deepest self, where we will find what is beyond our deepest self, which is the self with the big S, the presence of God or the divine milieu, or the Buddhists call it the absolute, or whatever name is given in the great religious traditions. They're referring to a mystery that is beyond concepts or words. Religion has always tried to say the impossible or to experience the impossible. That's its job, to interest people in that mystery that is beyond concepts and feelings and even experience, you might think. So the patiently have a period of time every day in silence. It speaks to a need that some people have already discovered, and it invites others to open themselves to something that they haven't yet discovered, but which would help them to integrate all their other activities and their life's history in a meaningful way into the corporate evolution of the human family, into its destiny, which seems to me is transformation. So our own transformation is profoundly related to everybody else's, and really can't go on without an openness or willingness. So we have to take everybody into our heart, including our enemies, if we want to be completely transformed, because basically this is what God does, or if you prefer, this is what nature is doing all the time, making a place for everybody. So both nature and God are infinite, so there's no lack of room for everybody. Okay.
I wonder if we might recommend to people that would like to know more about that that they visit Contemplative Outreach, contemplativeoutreach.org, all one word, contemplativeoutreach.org, and more information about centering prayer. And Father Thomas, your videos are there, and a lot of resources.
Oh, thank you for mentioning it.
And you're one of the founders of Contemplative Outreach as well. And again, just to continue this same theme in a sense, can you tell us just a little bit about another organization with which I've had some contact, the Monastic Interreligious Dialogue, and in that connection, your long friendship with His Holiness the Dalai Lama?
Yes, I'm happy to speak about that. In my opinion, His Holiness is certainly one of the most outstanding leaders in the world today. He certainly has grasped to its roots the meaning of compassion and the oneness of the human family and the importance of science in contributing to the ongoing revelation of who we are and what nature really is at the subatomic or the astronomic level. He's so good at being open to the discoveries of science. He's not rigid, he's not confined, and he's even said that if scientific discoveries should contradict some Buddhist teaching, he would, if their truth is reliable, he would recommend people to choose the scientific explanation. So he's interested in reality, and this, it seems to me, is the result of his penetrating it through the wonderful discipline the Buddhists have to that silence that I invited you to at the beginning of our chat. So after Vatican II, which ended in 1965, the Vatican authorities asked monks, especially in the Christian tradition, to dialogue with the monks and sisters and nuns of other world traditions, because it was felt that they would understand each other at a better level than most of the other dialogues, which I think is exactly right. So we began from nothing to make a intermonastic or interreligious dialogue here in the United States. There had been some start in Europe by a few months. So we had a wonderful meeting at, I think it was a convent in Petersham. And a number of significant people were there. And one of them was the foundress of the Temple of Understanding. She also had been around the world, or was several times trying to interest leaders in the world in her idea of inter-religious dialogue between all the religions. And there were several of them, some in Asia, and there was one at St. John the Divine in New York that I was able to attend. So there...
Juliet Hollister.
That was Juliet, yes. Thank you for prompting my aging memory, Jim. So that was one of the more extraordinary events. Of course, it was terribly boring while everybody from every tradition said a prayer in the end. Paul Winter was there with that incredible clarinet of his, and when he started blowing that thing for the... procession. Everybody, 10,000 people got on chairs, and this long procession of leaders from every tradition that Judas could mobilize, including His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop that Jim mentioned earlier, who was often called the Red Bishop, because did so much for the poor that everybody thought he was a communist. Well, anyway, that was the most extraordinary recession I ever saw. Lasted about 20 minutes to get everybody out, and they went the whole length of that enormous, I guess, the biggest cathedral in the world, while this music just ripped our emotions out of our tummy. And everybody was there, some of them in tears, and from all different kinds of traditions. So it was an expression of physical unity that I don't think has ever been surpassed. Of course, those moments are passing. We have to face that. Life goes on. But the remembrance of it and the grace that was there, I'm sure it has helped many people, because this ecumenical movement continues to grow. So I have a lot of conviction about the importance of that work and of developing union and unity and oneness in the minds of people who, because of centuries of geographical separation, think they're separated. They aren't. It's just one poor little planet in the middle of nowhere. It needs everybody to work together to make it work, otherwise it's going to have great problems surviving.
I feel that we're pursuing the same theme and moving a little bit deeper and deeper. And so I wonder if you'd care to say a few words about your fellow Trappist, the late Thomas Merton. He's such an inspiring figure for many of us who are involved in the interreligious movement and the global movement for social justice. And I think his contribution to the Christian opening to the East, to the kinds of things you're talking about, Father, to other religions, to the inner life, and to social justice, it really was unique, wasn't it?
Yes, I would certainly say he's a pioneer in a number of areas, but three major ones. He's looked upon as one of the great Christian writers, at least, of the last century, and he certainly was a genius as a writer. And I know he could write a whole book just from a few notes on a bulletin board, you might say, with hardly any correction. So he was really had a brilliant mind. But he had perceived, and he was, I don't know how much ahead of his time, but a lot. And so at first he wasn't too appreciated and had some trouble getting some of his books by his superiors. But the three things he tried to do in this order, I think, and which he got better and better at until his untimely death at one of these events that Judith Hollister organized in Bangkok, where all kinds of interreligious people from Asia gathered there, During the conference, he was electrocuted by accident. But anyway, it was just after he'd given a talk, too. But anyway, the three things that it seems to me he's pioneered and given a tremendous thrust to people of his religion is, first, to recover the contemplative dimension of the gospel. That is, to recover the lost emphasis on contemplation, interior silence, and to see its importance as a balance to action and ministry of any kind, but especially overaction and worldly kinds of action that are inevitable in any human institution that has to battle with bills and laws and legal difficulties and everything else. So that's what he started out to do in his first books. Then he got very interested in the social and peace aspect of contemplation, and he saw that you can't have one without the other, that there must be some participation in or awareness so that contemplative prayer is really intense and urgent and generous and sacrificing if it's going to be one's principal contribution to peace, as perhaps it is for a certain number of people. And finally, the third one that he pushed very strongly was this ecumenical sharing, and he had many correspondence with different scientists, different literary people like Pasternak. He was very close to Daniel Berrigan and others in the peace movement here. He was an inspiration to them. They made retreats out there. So he pushed those three events just by his very nature and with his books, with his articles, his letters, and he was equally gifted as a speaker and brilliant as a lecturer. So he died, he was still in his 50s when he passed away. So really what I've tried to do is to pick up what he had started with the recovery of the Christian contemplative tradition, rooted in the cloud of unknowing and Pseudo-Dionysius, Gregory of Nyssa, and some of the early fathers of the church. It's Risebrook. It's a very rich tradition, but was practically unknown when he started writing in the 40s, because it kind of got put in the back burner, and the Christian denominations had got too logged down in doctrinal arguments, so they didn't have any interest in pursuing those other things while they were still trying to straighten each other out. So he was a great gift to us and a great inspiration, and he's an industry in himself. His legacy has produced different kinds of books and sayings for every day and all kinds of reviews and evaluations of what he did. But he certainly shared in the vision of Teilhard de Chardin and Father Bede Griffiths and a couple of others whose names I can't remember right now, who are open to the transformation of humanity. In other words, who think that we're on the edge of an axial period, to put it that way, in which, in spite of all its miseries and violence, there's a seed moving at a deep level in humanity that is being nourished by this contemplative renewal and activated by social and peace activities and so on, that is going to begin to produce fruits in the next generation or two, but may take longer than that. In other words, as Teilhard said, biological evolution is pretty well complete. There's enough people on Earth. The focus now is on spiritual evolution, that is, on inspiring and bringing the human family to its ultimate meaning as perhaps the primary material intellect or combination of those in the universe, so that what has been made with its beauty can be appreciated and conserved, but perhaps needs that we can't even imagine at this point if we could allow ourselves to be converted to peace and justice. Perhaps there's some way of getting out into the universe where there's maybe all kinds of other worlds that we may be sent to help or to receive from. Who knows?
Well, I think it's interesting that you bring up the idea that ours might be a second axial age, the first axial age, the birth of the great classical religious traditions and of ethics and spirituality. And your friend and mine, Ewart Cousins, the late Ewart Cousins, who died a couple
yes.
of years ago, argued very strongly that we're in a second axial age. And so that's a perfect segue into this next question, which is that throughout this series, we've been talking about the possibility that ours is, in fact, an age of cultural evolutionary value shift, talking about a progressive shift, a change for the better. And in our conversations, we've touched on new approaches to peace and justice, a deepening sense of the sacredness of the earth and all life, and also the growth of religious pluralism. We've talked about that with Marcus Braybrook and Paul Nitter. How do you respond to that hopeful array, especially since you introduced it with the idea that we might be on some kind of a threshold or a seed has been planted?
Yes, there's a whole new world opening up to the ancient religions, and new religions for that matter, and that is this pluralism is not just to see how many religions we can think up, but at least to begin with the great ones that have committed to the cultures, and to see if we can bring them together, especially on the spiritual level, where all the evidence is pointing to the fact that talking about similar, if not the same, experiences of contemplative prayer, or the way that the divine penetrates all of creation and moves it, and that we are called to now to co-create the future with God, since we have the intelligence, and He expects us to do so, but within the parameters of some of the great insights of the world religions regarding morality, especially that surround justice and equal rights for everyone, and respect for the earth, and all the other things that you mentioned. This is what humans should be doing. I mean, that's a revolutionary destiny and duty. But so far, most of us are not fully leading a human life in the sense of using our capacity for abstract knowledge to really love each other and to forgive and to practice compassion and to get along. And so the vocation of religions now, it seems to me, is not to convert people to their particular persuasion as a primary object, but to create communion in the human family, that is, friendship, love, understanding, respect. So in my view, if you don't love all the other religions, you're not practicing your own correctly. Now, I admit that this isn't perceived by everybody as yet, but it seems to me when it is perceived, then what is best in all the great traditions can be shared and deepen the particular path that each of us is on and open us to the possibility of transcending it. Now, this is a little difficult subject to explain, but is religion the goal of human life, or is it a means or a path of leading us to that goal, which is the transformed level of consciousness that transpersonal psychologists call unitive or unity, or beyond that? We don't even know other possibilities of development, but at least unless we team up with each other, and this is happening at the level now for the first time in human history of really great teachers getting together and sharing what helped them most in their own tradition, which often helps other people, even though they remain in their own tradition, to practice it better with a fuller understanding and appreciation. But it emphasizes that beyond the particularities of religion, there's a common transformed consciousness that needs to penetrate the mystery of creation and to contact the presence of that which is, or whatever you call it, and out of that experience to serve the desperate needs of humanity and its poverty and neglect, and to oppose without violence the greed and the selfishness of those who are, let's put it frankly, just not evolved as humans yet.
Right. Well, we have about 2 minutes left, and in light of what you've just said, and also a suggestion that was put forth on the board here from Rebecca, that we should all be thinking in terms of movement for a better world. What's happening in the Middle East, the democracy movement? I think we all agree that can go either way, but the idea that this is a fit subject for prayer and contemplation, hoping for a halt to the violence, and that the movement turns out to be as productive as it might. But as we wind up here, Father, I wonder, since most of the listeners on this call are personally engaged in peace and justice work at the local or regional level. And as you know, that work can sometimes be very trying. And I wonder if you just have, for a minute or so, a word or two of spiritual counsel for all of us who would like to be of service to each other and to the world.
Well, I'm sure you've got plenty of great advisors, given the wonderful list of people associated with your respective movements there. And having been exposed to the peace counselors, really remarkable people. I love them so much. And the great patriarch of Thailand, you know, used to lead people personally on foot through the minefields, I guess, was it Cambodia and Thailand?
Cambodia.
And as a way of healing the terrible damage of the Khmer Rouge and so on. And so that would take 2 weeks. This wasn't just an afternoon's walk. And people, as you know, are still being blown up there and by those mines. But his witness meant so much to people. Many people would come out to the road to meet him on one leg. That was all that was left of their ambulatory capacities. And many of these were children. So I can only say that if you're going to give your life or your best efforts to justice and peace, don't expect to be congratulated. You'll get be lucky if you're not persecuted or murdered. It's not a joyride to bliss or heaven. It's a tremendous commitment of love, of compassion to the human family, and perhaps it's the only thing that can triumph over the desperate need for greed and power and security symbols that provide endless defenses from every kind of possible harm. All of these things are self-centered and focus all of the human resources on our protection or success or achievement, not even in the spiritual realm, but achievement in the worldly sense of that term. So to do what we can, trusting in God or the higher power or however you understand it, or the absolute or the meaning of the universe, the divine ground is certainly a marvelously common image that comes from Meister Eckhart. To do what we can without expecting to succeed right away, and that whatever we accomplish, definitely contributing to this transformation, so that we're not blown away by either success or failure. It's a huge project. In fact, it seems to be the whole project of human life from the beginning, to evolve out of animal consciousness into fully human reflective consciousness that can be grateful and love and forgive, have compassion and work together and understand its oneness with all that is and appreciate it.
Father, I just want to thank you for a marvelous conversation. I think everyone is really grateful. This has been absolutely terrific. We hope you can stay with us for a little bit longer. Barbara, I'll turn it over to you.
Father Thomas, you're clearly, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, a simple monk with a great deal of humility. But for us, having you with us today is a rare privilege. So I wonder if you could stay with us, and I'd like to take just a few questions from our panel.
Sure.
And also from our participant base, because we don't get this opportunity so often. So first of all, I'd like to ask our panelists, if any of you have a question for Father Keating, if you could use number 1 on your telephone keypad, and that will let us know if you're raising your hand for a question. I see, Roger, that you've got your hand up. Would you like to ask a question? Your mic is activated.
Okay, great, thanks. Father, again, thank you for a wonderful conversation. And what I would ask is, as we enrich our beingness through contemplation, meditation, and then move out in some kind of congruent action, how can one move with intention and action and yet also release the attachments? Because it seems to me that possibly attachments to outcomes can get in the way of meaningful action, and yet there has to be intentionality. Can you speak a little to that?
Well, this is a subject, you know, the Bhagavad Gita has discussed at great length, where Lord Krishna explains to the hero how he has to try to work without looking for any reward back. That isn't easy for human nature, especially in our culture that's so orientated towards success stories and accomplishment and the American dream and so on. Well, all those things have some value, but not much. The real value is in servant leadership. That is to say, in trying to offer what we have in the way of our gifts. But because of the habits of a lifetime and the false self, which is grown into a fairly sizable ego in most of us, we don't know how to do this. And so life itself in our efforts, especially failure, is one of the greatest gifts that God, it seems to me, gives us to learn that we're dependent on Him for everything that happens, and that we're serving this for His honor and glory, and the love of others who are in great need, and not for ourselves. And therefore, if we don't get anything out of it, we have already got what we wanted by having the honor of serving the human family and the divine presence in it. So I think everybody has to find their own little means of checking on their motivation as we go along, and especially when we're hurt or feel rejected or turned down or not appreciated. All of these are human reactions, very understandable, but they're not the Spirit of God. Since there's a mixture of both in us, which seems to me we have to keep praying that God would deliver us, and that we not to expect that we'll be able to accomplish that inner freedom with our own efforts alone. And I think it takes time. I'm now 88 almost. I think I'm just beginning. I've been 70 years at this journey. And I keep seeing new levels in myself where there's remnants of selfishness. Or of course, it's normal to feel anger, but we're not our feelings and we're not our thoughts. So those are not problems. It's the attachment to something that continuously produces anger, whether it's the desire to succeed that fails or something else. So what the gospel of freedom is trying to do is liberate us from our false self apparatus and the systems and the way they work that are inevitable in everybody, yes, because we come into this world without the experience of God, and hence we have to find it. In the meantime, how do we survive? Well, we try to take care of ourselves as best we can in the context of our culture or religious persuasion. And to be humble is to be humiliated often enough to enable it to happen, to really believe it and to be peaceful about it. It's not just enough to feel humiliated, because then you can get angry or bitter. But it's important to be content, to be little unknown, unnoticed, and so on. This is the kind of rejection that almost every human being experienced something of, and must be part of God's plan to bring us into a state of total receptivity, which is what contemplation certainly is during prayer, and receive the pure love of God as a gratuitous gift. And I think we're ready to function fairly freely in the area of serving others without demanding a thank you. Nice to have it. It's not the reason we're working.
No, that's wonderful. Thank you, Father Thomas, and thank you, Roger, for that question, because that was on my mind as well. Let's take one more question from Madeline right now.
Thank you, Father Thomas, for your wonderful remarks. The question I have is that if I think about what I believe, my understanding of what you're saying about interspirituality, I think in another place you use the term religions sharing a common heart, and like charity being the common heart. And then the expressions of that vary because of our traditions and different cultures. My question is that what if anything, should religious leaders do when some of those expressions seem to foster violence or attitudes that could lead to violence? I'm thinking of sacred texts in various world traditions, religious traditions, that seem to advocate violence.
Well, my answer to that is to draw a little on the great scholarship scripture scholars in the past 100 years, and I think it's going to continue, as well as from anthropology and sociology. This is why the religions of the world have to take science seriously now, especially psychology, anthropology. I think if they don't, they're going to be in trouble. But what science is telling us is that you can't climb out of your culture completely. That even on the spiritual journey, I think most of us are aware that you only get free of your cultural conditioning or educational background or biases and prejudices from early religious training with the greatest difficulty and slowly. So I would say I don't think that God agrees with everything that's in the Bible. It's what very well-intentioned people with a certain level of spirituality were able to say about God or think about God 4,000 or 5,000 years ago in some cases. So it doesn't mean that's the end of the journey, but that was the best they could do in a culture in which defensiveness and violence was taken for granted or the only way to survive, with surrounded by enemies with their hatchets ready to chop you up. So I would feel that we need a greater wisdom and critical eye on some of the things that the Bible certainly says, and the exhortation, some of which are horrendous, to wipe out different peoples and bang the children's heads against rocks and so on. This is not the right idea of God, but it's the best these folks in their anger or desire for revenge could do. And if anything, I would be inclined to leave out such texts now that we have plenty of others in the Bible, and especially in the New Testament, that speak of something else. For instance, how can you talk about a punishing God, which of course lots of people do, including some of the greatest saints, how can you talk about that? When God is love, what would the world would interest God in punishment? What interests God is in healing us of the wounds of our difficult journey from animal instincts into the peace and balance and intelligence of human beings. The neocortex is part of the brain that's fairly new, and most people think that's where the human capacities come from. So I think we have to look at the scriptures again, and that not every word is something we have to believe. And that, like reading any book, the author reflects the ideas or the culture of its time And it would be miraculous if they came up with Gandhian nonviolence at the time that some of those texts were written in the Bible. At least this is my suggestion, and lots of good people wouldn't agree with it. But I can't accept God as some parts of Scripture present him. I think they're projections of some very angry people who are trying to get God's help but really don't know how to go about it properly, and their anger keeps getting the best of them. And perhaps that's sufficient to address your very important question.
I think some of those prophets of the Old Testament could benefit from some anger management workshops.
Yes, well, we can only represent our age. 1,000 years from now, where people look upon us as pretty dense and narrow-minded and so on. But we have to keep trying and pushing the limits of human self-surrender or acceptance or openness farther than we want them to go ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, to push beyond the cultural limits all the time. And that's how, seems to me, humanity has grown in its, some degree at least, in its, but now it's at the very verge, it seems to me, of an enormous breakthrough where the religions of the world have to talk to each other. You live together, and populations are interpenetrating each other, so there isn't the separation that might be an excuse for looking upon another religion as having horns or something else diabolical. That's childish, I think we see now. So without disrespecting the people who manifested their time as best they could, we have to leave behind some of their misconceptions in the light of serious modern science or the possibilities of other explanations for how the scripture is written.